Well, good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks very much for tuning in a little bit tonight to join in the fun and frivolity that we commit here every night, right? Huh? No, you don't agree? Well, the hell with you then. It's about 7 past the hour. We are going to have a couple of sound bites tonight from last night's debate. And I noticed when I was listening to the sound bites, I think we only have 2 or 3, they're weighted heavily in favor of Barack Obama. So I'm going to balance that out. I have an email from our Arkansas bureau chief, Joyce, that I will share with you as a way of balancing the obvious prejudice that you will hear vis-a-vis Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's debate last night. Fair enough. William F. Buckley died today. About the only issue with which I agreed with Buckley was his advocacy against the criminalization of marijuana. He was an advocate for legalizing marijuana. But a couple of items here about Buckley, and then we have a piece of old sound that we're going to play for you. Comes to us courtesy of our resident philosopher, Bob Alexander. But Buckley was a racist, and he believed Negroes should, as the Christian Bible advocated for slaves, Negroes should accept their fate and remain calm. Among other things, Buckley believed that black folks in America should forget about the idea of universal suffrage, of voting. He subsequently, when it was pointed out to him how racist the statement was, he included poor whites with that. But the original statement was about black people. Buckley just never could bring himself to admit that he was a National Socialist, that he was, in fact, a Nazi, not a corporatist, a Nazi, of the same stripe as Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and E.I. DuPont and some of the big titans of American industry. Had these people just come out and said, okay, we're going to form the American Nazi Party and then let people deal with it on that level. But no, he identified himself as a conservative, which he was not. He advocated that people with AIDS be tattooed. The Nazis advocated and came up with tattoos for Jews. The few remaining Holocaust survivors who were sent to the death camps will testify by sliding up the sleeve of their shirt. As far as I know, William Buckley is the first person in modern history who advocated the tattooing of people who were sick. He was opposed to First Amendment rights, except for the elites in the society. His idea of press freedom was freedom for those with a press, if they were conservative. And in a now famous back and forth between he and Gore Vidal, a portion of which we're going to play for you a little bit later, he makes the claim during the 1968 presidential or the Democratic convention in Chicago, when people were being beaten into bloody pulp for exercising their First Amendment rights. Buckley suggests that there is no absolute guarantee of the right of freedom of assembly, even though it seems fairly obvious in the First Amendment. He was a CIA operative for a couple of years, beginning in 1951. Little has been published regarding Mr. Buckley's work with the CIA, but in a 2001 letter to author W. Thomas Smith, Jr., Buckley wrote, quote, "I did training in Washington as a secret agent, and I was sent to Mexico City. There I served under the supervision of E. Howard Hunt, about whom, of course, a great deal is known." Buckley also founded the National Review in 1955. Now, regarding his association with E. Howard Hunt, aside from the fact that E. Howard Hunt was a felon, a spy. Let me just add a couple things. Howard Hunt worked for the CIA. Later, he was one of the White House plumbers under Richard Nixon. It was Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy and others who formed this plumbers unit, a secret team of operatives charged with fixing leaks and information disclosures inside the Nixon crime family had proved an embarrassment to Nixon. especially when defense analyst Daniel Ellsberg sent a series of documents, which came to be known as the Pentagon Papers, to the New York Times. So Hunt, along with G. Gordon Liddy, engineered the first Watergate burglary. In the ensuing Watergate scandal, Hunt was convicted of burglary, conspiracy, wiretapping. He eventually served 33 months in prison. And last year, do you remember his son released an audio tape, a deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt, naming Lyndon B. Johnson and ranking members of the CIA as the orchestrators of the Kennedy assassination? And I know a lot of people went, oh, please. E. Howard Hunt, if I'm not mistaken, was a fairly religious man. He was on his deathbed when he said this. In Mexico, in the early 50s, Hunt helped devise something called Operation PB Success. And that was the plan to overthrow the elected presidency of Guatemala's president, Jacobo Arbenz. And they were successful in doing that. They overthrew the government of Guatemala and established a dictatorship that took 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 decades to come out from under. And some will argue that they still haven't. Following assignments in Japan and Uruguay, Hunt was assigned to forge Cuban exile leaders in the United States into a government in exile that would, after the Bay of Pigs invasion, form a provisional government to take over Cuba. And, of course, the failure of that invasion damaged his career. After the Bay of Pigs, Hunt became a personal assistant to Alan Dulles. Hunt was assigned to temporary duty as the acting CIA station chief in Mexico City for the period of August and September 1963. That's when Lee Harvey Oswald visited there. After the Bay of Pigs invasion, of course, Kennedy fired Dulles. It was referred to as involuntary retirement in 1961. And shortly thereafter, the assassination of Jack Kennedy was put together and arranged. You can make the argument, or I can make the argument, that William F. Buckley may have been part and parcel of that conspiracy, at least to the extent that he worked in Mexico City with the CIA at the very time the guy that shot, Lee Harvey Oswald, the time that Lee Harvey Oswald was there. Now, if you want to put on your tinfoil hat and play this game with me, go ahead. If not, okay. But William F. Buckley, E. Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy, Lee Harvey Oswald, isn't it interesting that somehow, some way, they all kind of came together and flowed across each other's trails over and over and over again, up to and including the assassination of John Kennedy. According to E. Howard Hunt's son, Hunt claimed the other assassin was a French gunman who did shoot from the grassy knoll, as a lot of people have surmised. He's been identified as one Lucien Sarti. And it just goes on and on. This kind of stuff never stops. This was the cohort of William F. Buckley. So today, when I listen to NBC, for example, Brian Williams on NBC delivering his 2 or 3 minute package on the wonders of William F. Buckley, how he was a great American. He was argumentative, and some people agreed, some didn't agree, but he was a great American. Isn't it interesting that Buckley and Hunt and Liddy and Lee Harvey Oswald and all of these people just kind of, floated in the same commode together, didn't they? Isn't that interesting?
It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going, we better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody everybody look what's brewing. We better stop now. What's that?
Twenty-one past the hour. So, Buckley steps off this mortal coil today. As Bob wrote to me, Buckley was editor, columnist, novelist, debater, TV talk show host, conservative gas bag, and Republican apologist. The fact that he could lie using big words seemingly impressed the people he was lying to. He was the preeminent spokesman for the brand of loathsome conservatism that has delivered this country into a quasi-dictatorship and brought hell on earth to several countries on this planet. Good riddance. All right, now we want to play this for you. This is from August 1968. Buckley's so-called erudition, his elitist attitude kind of left him when he reacted to Gore Vidal calling him a crypto-Nazi, a hidden Nazi. And it's in that exchange, Buckley said, "Now listen, you queer," referring to Gore Vidal, "stop calling me a crypto-Nazi or I'll sock you in your goddamn face and you'll stay plastered." When you listen to these two, just remember there was a time in this country, and not so long ago, when this sort of an exchange could be heard on the air.
"Mr. Vidal, wasn't it a provocative act to try to raise the Viet Cong flag in the park in the film we just saw? Wouldn't that invite raising a Nazi flag in World War II would have had similar consequences?"
"You must realize what some of the political issues are here, that many people in the United States happen to believe that the United States policy is wrong in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong are correct in wanting to organize their country in their own way politically. This happens to be pretty much the opinion of Western Europe and many other parts of the world. If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. But I assume that the point of the American democracy
and some
is you can express
too.
Any
some
point of view you want."
"Nazi.
Shut up a minute."
"No, I won't. And some people were pro-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers. I know you don't
as
care.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro- or crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Let's stop calling names. Now listen, you queer, stop calling me a crypto-Nazi. Let's stop calling names. Your goddamn face, and you'll stay plastered. Gentlemen, let's... Let Myron Breckinridge go back to his pornography and stop making any allusions of Nazism to somebody
who
was infantry in the last war.
You were not in the infantry, as a matter of fact. You were not. You're distorting your own military record."
Okay. Good God.
"I would just like to know when Miss Katharine Hepburn was invited into that debate, because that's all I heard was Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. And when in America did people really talk like this anyway?
There was a time." So Bob says, "I never thought he was smart. I just thought he was sick or slick. Entirely different. Smart people may lie and steal from you. Slick people do it just to keep in practice." William F. Buckley. He was found... according to the family, was found slumped over his desk in his office. From last night, we got time for this? Last night's debate? No? You want to hold off? All right. We'll do that when we come back.
"I'm sorry, darling. I'm shaking a martini right now, so just shut your damn mouth, okay?"
Okay. Michael in Harrisburg, PA, who's a Nova M Founders Club member, writes... about the debate last night, Mike writes, "I guess I don't understand why, when these moronic moderators insist on pressing questions that are about trivial crap and intended simply to get the candidates mad, why doesn't Barack or Hillary simply respond with something like, 'Oh, come on, Tim, grow up. The country is going to hell in a handbasket, and you insist on asking about photos of my opponent on a trip to Africa? Really now?' Or, 'What are you trying to do here, Tim? The voters don't give a rat's ass about whether my opponent went on, what my opponent went about health care. Oh, damn. The voters don't give a rat's ass about whether my opponent went about health care the wrong way 15 years ago. They want to know what we're going to do in the next 4 years. Why don't you ask us about that? Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I get so tired of hearing people who present themselves, or at least we have assumed, that they are reasonably intelligent. People like the National Network anchors, or someone like Tim Russert, even though we know in our heart of hearts that they're not all that intelligent. They may be adept at what they do, but the assumption is that they are in the positions that they are in because they are capable of approaching candidates with questions that are pertinent to what we need to know in order to make an informed choice. And how often does that happen? How often does it happen that a question is asked of these candidates that matters worth a damn to your future, your kids, my kids, where our next paycheck's coming from? What, you know, it's very irritating. Oh, and by the way, in a regarding the that huge 143 million pounds of beef that was recalled in a Ron Paul libertarian world, for all you diehard Ron Paul supporters out there, do you think that beef, possibly tainted with mad cow disease, would have been recalled in a Ron Paul administration? Huh? Remember what the libertarians believe. Government has no business regulating your beef.
Your rage on. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, we want to play a couple of clips for you from last night's debate. These were cut by our producer, associate producer Ian Huff. I guess since we were otherwise busy today, I have no idea. But we're going to play these for you. And he sent us a bunch, but we picked the ones that we thought were interesting, which will thoroughly piss off Hillary Clinton supporters. But we will try to balance that with a letter extremely critical of Barack Obama immediately that comes from our Arkansas bureau chief, Joyce, immediately after these clips. So here's the first one. This is Hillary... I hate to use the word whining because that's what my 3.5-year-old does sometimes, but it sounds very much like whining about always getting the first question in the debates. Maybe that is some kind of sexism, since we are so used to, you know, saying "after you, ma'am" or opening the door. You know, all right. So maybe she's got a point. Maybe it's very sexist. Maybe it's very condescending, offering the first question to the female candidate. But anyway, she complains about it, whines about it, and then tries to crack wise about the Saturday Night Live skit about how much the media loves Barack Obama.
Well, can I just point out that in the last several debates, I seem to get the first question all the time. And I don't mind. I'll be happy to field them, but I do find it curious. And if anybody saw Saturday Night Live, you know, maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow. I just find it kind of curious that I keep getting the first question on all of these issues.
Offer Barack another pillow? Okay. Then Brian Williams played the Hillary clip where she mocked Obama's style of political speech. And then asks Obama to respond here. So the first part of this is Hillary from a day or two before the debate in Cleveland last night, and then it goes back to the live moment. So listen to this one.
Now, I could stand up here and say, let's just get everybody together. Let's get unified. The sky will open. The light will come down. Celestial choirs will be singing. And everyone will know we should do the right thing and the world will be perfect.
How did you take those remarks when you heard
them? Well, I thought Senator Clinton showed some good humor there. I would give her points for delivery.
and points for delivery. Okay, well, that's cool. Now, this next one, Barack Obama explains why Hillary Clinton is wrong on Iraq.
My objections to the war in Iraq were simply not simply a speech. I was in the midst of a U.S. Senate campaign. It was a high-stakes campaign. I was one of the most vocal opponents of the war, and I was very specific as to why. And so when I bring this up, it is not simply to say I told you so, but it is to give you an insight in terms of how I would make decisions. And the fact was, this was a big strategic blunder. It was not a matter of, well, here is the initial decision, but since then we've voted the same way. Once we had driven the bus into the ditch, there were only so many ways we could get out. The question is, who's making the decision initially to drive the bus into the ditch? And the fact is that Senator Clinton often says that she is ready on day one, but in fact she was ready to give in to George Bush on day one on this critical issue.
And it's not just, I don't think Barack Obama had had the time or maybe the inclination to explain what John Broder explains in the New York Times regarding Hillary Clinton's vote on the war. It wasn't just one vote. There were essentially two votes. And you have to ask yourself, of these two votes where Hillary Clinton voted in favor of Bush's action, what, was it just political expediency, or did she really believe at the time that the invasion and occupation of Iraq was a good idea? As Broder points out, during last night's during a Democratic debate in Los Angeles a week or so ago, Clinton was asked to explain why she had voted against an amendment to that 2002 war resolution that authorized the use of force in Iraq. Prior to all the senators voting on that, there was an amendment, the Carl Levin Amendment. And Clinton said she opposed the amendment because she favored, not because she favored going to war, but because Carl Levin's amendment would have, in her word, subordinated American national security decision-making to the UN Security Council. Now, the vote on the Levin Amendment came just hours before the Senate voted to approve the resolution that Bush later used to justify the invasion of Iraq. And Clinton voted for that resolution. She voted against the Levin resolution. In an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press a couple of months ago, Hillary Clinton said, quote, "The Levin Amendment, in my view, gave the Security Council of the UN a veto over American presidential power. I don't believe that is an appropriate policy for the United States, no matter who's our president," end quote. Well, in the first place, it is impossible for the UN to have a veto power over actions taken by the United States Senate or the President of the United States. It simply is an impossibility. Levin, Senator Carl Levin, and defenders of his amendment said that her description of the measure that she voted against is simplistic and misleading. The amendment was designed to rein in Bush, who many believed was embarked at the time on his little inexorable march to war, which he was. The measure giving him permission required two steps. First, the UN would have to pass a resolution explicitly authorizing the use of force against Iraq if it did not permit thorough inspections of its weapons programs. Now, why would it take a UN resolution? Because it was the UN that was doing the inspections. There was a UN mandate regarding the sanctions. It was a UN oil for food agreement. The UN was, in fact, running most of the business of Iraq. Consequently, it's logical for a resolution having to be passed that would authorize the use of force by anyone against Iraq. But the fact remains that if a president or a Senate of the United States decides to issue a war declaration, there is no UN power whatsoever to prevent that. So Hillary Clinton is being completely disingenuous here. Now, secondly, the amendment that she voted against required Bush to return to Congress if his UN efforts failed. In other words, if the UN said, no, you can't have your war resolution, then it required Bush to come back to Congress, the House and the Senate, and to secure passage of what Levin called a going-it-alone unilateral resolution. In other words, if the UN said no, then there was an amendment to giving Bush authority to start this war that said, okay, if the UN says no, you got to come back and ask us, and we'll probably tell you yes. Former Senator Lincoln Chafee, a Republican of Rhode Island, who was in the Senate at the time and supported the Levin Amendment, wrote last year that both the amendment, the Levin Amendment, was unambiguous and compatible with international law. There was no question of what was going on here. Chafee wrote in the New York Times, ceding no rights or sovereignty to an international body, the amendment explicitly avowed America's right to defend itself if threatened. Now, Clinton now says, no. That amendment would have given the United Nations power over actions of the United States Senate and the President of the United States. That is either a lie, or Hillary Clinton did not understand the amendment, or she doesn't understand the U.S. Constitution, for God's sake. Chafee went on to say at the time that he said the demand for thorough inspections in Iraq would succeed only if pushed by a broad coalition, including Arab states. That was not going on. Chafee concluded, quote, unfortunately, these arguments fell on deaf ears in that emotionally charged, hawkish post-9/11 moment, less than 4 weeks before a midterm election. The amendment, the Levin Amendment, was defeated 75-24. Later that night, the Iraq War Resolution was approved 77-23. It was clear that most senators were immune to persuasion because the two votes were almost mirror images of each other. No to the Levin Amendment, yes to war. Their minds were made up. Now, here's the fact, and it's an inconvenient fact, isn't it? Hillary Clinton voted twice to authorize Bush to use force without a declaration of war against this beat-up, sad, miserable third-world country that has now resulted in the deaths of thousands of American soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians. And now Hillary Clinton is trying to run away from her record. Now, if you're a Hillary Clinton supporter, I would just ask you, why? That's all. That's a fair question. Why is Hillary Clinton running away from her vote, two of her votes? And this very seldom, if ever, comes up. Twice she voted in the same night to allow the president, this half-ass George W. Bush, to initiate, shock and awe, this disastrous invasion of Iraq. Twice Hillary Clinton voted to approve it. And now she said, well, you know, if I had a chance, I would take my vote back. Senator Clinton, which vote?
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
It's about 10 before the hour. Let's play this last one, this last soundbite from last night's debate. This is Barack Obama explaining why he would make a better candidate than Hillary Clinton against John McCain.
While I've been in the United States Senate, and as somebody who, during the course of this campaign, I think has put forward a plan that will provide a clean break against Bush and Cheney, and that is how we're going to be able to debate John McCain. Having a debate with John McCain where your positions were essentially similar until you started running for president, I think does not put you in a strong position.
And that's essentially correct, isn't it? How is Hillary Clinton going to respond in a debate with John McCain, where McCain says, look, Hillary, you voted the same way I did on the Iraq War resolution and the amendment preceding that vote that no one seems to know about. In almost every single issue, if you look at the voting records of John McCain and Hillary Clinton, they are very similar. So, I mean, Clinton supporters can say, okay, look, Malloy, she had to go along with it in order to build up her credibility with the right-wingers. She had to go along with it so they wouldn't start ripping her to pieces, because her ultimate goal was to become the greatest president since FDR. And if that meant Hillary had to disguise herself as a conservative, why are you bitching about it, Malloy? Okay, if that's what you believe, go for it. I can't argue against that kind of belief. That's like arguing against someone who thinks Rush Limbaugh is just the greatest thing since they put toilet paper on rolls. But I'll say what I've always said. I think I've always said this. Maybe I haven't. Check the records. Take a look at their voting records. And include Barack Obama's time in the Illinois legislature, since Hillary Clinton is including her time as the First Lady. I mean, that's only fair, isn't it? And now the IRS is investigating the United Church of Christ over a speech that Barack Obama gave at its national meeting last year after he became a candidate for president. Boy, when they start turning up the pressure against a candidate, they don't stop, do they, huh? Barack Obama, last June, addressed a national meeting of the United Church of Christ in Hartford, Connecticut, and the IRS now is investigating the circumstances surrounding the speech, saying, quote, reasonable belief exists, end quote, that the denomination, the United Church of Christ, violated restrictions on political activity for tax-exempt organizations. I want to scream, what? After what we've gone through with the Christian Coalition and Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and Hagee and all these psychopathic, drooling, mouth-breathing so-called Christians plastering radio and television and newspapers and their churches and their meeting houses and their snake-handling Wednesday night congregations with anti-democratic, anti-Canada, anti-Kerry. Jesus Christ, who was the guy out in Missouri, the Catholic priest, who said anyone who voted for Kerry would be denied the sacraments? And you never hear of those investigations, do you? And do you know why? Because they do not occur. But now Barack Obama's church is being investigated because he gave a speech at a national meeting of the United Church of Christ. There's 1.2 million members to this Protestant group. This is the liberal branch of Protestant Christianity. Obama, who is also a member of that. You know, a lot of the right-wingers say, oh, he's a Muslim. No, he's not. He's a member of the Trinity United Church of Christ. He's a Christian. He's a Protestant. And at this, at this meeting, he spoke about faith and public life. This was at the United Church of Christ denomination's June 2007 General Synod in Hartford, Connecticut. The IRS said in their letter that it was concerned about articles posted on the church's website. Rah! A spokesman for the United Church of Christ said a group of Obama volunteers was outside the Hartford Civic Center when the event took place, and they were told specifically they could not enter the meeting. The United Church of Christ had invited Obama to speak a year before he announced he was running for president because of his involvement in the denomination. Hi, I'm a senator. I'm part of the church. I hear you're having a meeting. I'd like to come and give a speech. Church leaders consulted with lawyers before the event. to make sure they followed the IRS rules. Before Obama spoke at this convocation, a top church official told the crowd that the senator's talk was not a campaign-related event and that no leaflets or signs of political support would be allowed. Reverend John Thomas, president of the United Church of Christ, called the inquiry, quote, disturbing, unquote. Thomas said in a statement, quote, when the invitation to an elected public official to speak to the national meeting of his own church family is called into question, it has a chilling effect on every religious community, end quote. Now you tell me, what does this smell like? Huh? What does it smell like? And I've got people emailing me telling me that Barack Obama's campaign is a Karl Rove operation. There's not too much that I can say. Brooke writes, Mike, your esteemed representative from Georgia, Jack Kingston, referred to Obama as Barack Hussein Obama on Bill Maher on Friday night. I'm guessing, Brooke writes, the talking point memo went out around last Thursday or Friday. You know damn well those bastards put the word out to start painting him as a Muslim because they can't say anything about him that he hasn't already said about himself. Brooke ends by saying, God, I pray this won't work again. They're working on his wife as unpatriotic, too. Yeah, and now, Brooke, they're going after his church. We'll be back after the break with a letter from Joyce, our Arkansas Bureau Chief. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. This is the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Mike Malloy. Yeah, I'm getting tired of the Clinton-Obama debate. Yes, I am. But and it's soon going to be one of them and McCain. But I think this is fairly critical stuff. We have had 8 years of the most hideous mismanagement of this country in recent history. And the person we elect, ostensibly to try to get us out of this, is going to be critical. And I think it is necessary to devote an amount of time, a considerable amount of time, to both to the candidacy of whomever or the selection process to determine the candidate or the nominee from the Democratic Party, and then subsequent to that, the debates or the confrontations or the mudslinging or the lies and deceptions that will be spread by the Republicans as we approach Election Day. So it's getting on my nerves, too. I know a lot of you are sick of it. You'd much rather, if you're going to do talk radio at all, you'd much rather be doing something else. There are other issues, and I understand that and agree with it. But I'm in a position where it's just required right now, I think, not required of me by anyone, but just required by the circumstances that we devote an amount of time to this that seems out of proportion to regularly scheduled programming. But anyway. All right. This is from our Arkansas Bureau Chief, Joyce. Mike. Hi, Mike. Although Barack Obama and I most likely walked the same streets on the south side of Chicago, my hometown, I know little about him except his oratorical skills and his legislative tenures. Realizing that he may be the Democratic candidate, and for some sense of reassurance, I did a Google about a week or so ago with results that were very disturbing. Particularly troublesome was his megachurch, his pastor, Dr. Jeremiah Wright, who is his spiritual and political advisor, and Minister Louis Farrakhan, leader of the racist Nation of Islam. Surprisingly, at the debate in Cleveland last night, Tim Russert, media whore number one, actually questioned Obama about Farrakhan, but only about Farrakhan's endorsement. Obama replied that he hadn't asked for Farrakhan's support and fully disavowed Farrakhan's racial rhetoric. Russert should have asked if campaign donations either already received or any in the future would be returned. One can only wonder how many of Obama's million-man-woman benefactors, averaging $109 each, may have been assisted by Farrakhan, the leader of the Million Man March, who resides in Chicago. Obama's place of worship, Trinity United Church of Christ, has a congregation of 6,000, and many are of the Muslim faith. Most folks unfamiliar with Islam would think nothing of it. However, according to Islamic law, any Muslim attending a Christian church or converting to Christianity or, God forbid, Judaism would be placed on a death list. Something about this just doesn't smell right. Is there something about this church that isn't known? Each year, a notable African American is chosen by Trinity United Church of Christ to receive its highest award for social achievement. This prestigious honor is named for the pastor, the Dr. Jeremiah A. Wright Jr. Trumpet Award. In December 2007, the recipient of the gala was Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam. Dr. Wright has been the church's pastor for 20 years and, as stated above, is Obama's spiritual and political advisor. The pastor's daughter, Jerry Wright, is a publisher of the church magazine, The Trumpet, which featured an article on Farrakhan's award. When Obama was asked about the Farrakhan Award, he sidestepped the question, saying it was just something in a magazine. The renowned Maxine Waters, Democratic representative from California, was a recent recipient of the church's annual award. Perhaps she knows something that we don't. She has endorsed Hillary Clinton. The following quote from Minister Farrakhan when Obama was a senatorial candidate should give pause for thought. Quote, he, Obama, has been groomed to be seen more as a unifier, end quote. The Republicans have worked hard to run Obama. The Republicans have worked hard to run against Obama and are close to achieving their Rovian goal. Many Democrats seem to be fatally mesmerized. I fear they will have a tragic awakening when McCain, that crazy warmonger, takes his oath of office. God help us all. Joyce in Arkansas. Joyce has been a regular listener to this program, I think, since WLS days. So we're talking a decade. I don't know what to say to this. She writes, the Trinity United Church of Christ has a congregation of 6,000. Many are of the Muslim faith. I have no idea about that statement. Joyce, I don't know where you didn't source it, so I don't know where the information is coming from. I don't know what you mean. As far as guilt by association, sure. I think that's fair. I did it earlier in the program tonight. William F. Buckley and E. Howard Hunt. In Mexico, at the same time, both CIA operatives, right about the time the government of Guatemala was overthrown. The meetings between E. Howard Hunt and Lee Harvey Oswald, the deathbed confession of Hunt that the CIA was behind the assassination of Kennedy. Okay, I guess that's kind of guilt by association, too, because I'm loading a lot of that onto Buckley. So if there is something inherently evil about Minister Farrakhan, who, by the way, as my understanding, is right on the verge of kicking off as a result of the cancer he's been dealing with for years. I don't know. When I lived in Chicago, I used to listen to Farrakhan. I found him fascinating in the same way a mongoose or a cobra finds each other fascinating, I guess. I'm very aware of his racist rantings from 20 years ago. I used to watch him on television here in Atlanta, late night television. Minister Farrakhan standing up there with pure demonic racism. It can be seen as purely demonic racism until you stop and consider the broader context. And that would be what black folk in this country, Muslim or not, have dealt with for the longest damn time. It's so easy to label these people racist when where they're coming from is a reactionary point of view. As far as the founder of the Nation of Islam, if you check into that, the founder who was... oh, my God, I'm drawing a blank on his name, too. This is a bad night, Kathy. I have to up the Aricept dosage, I guess. But when you consider how that organization, church, religion, was put together, it brings into question what its real goals were. If you remember Malcolm X, who was a member of the Nation of Islam until he made his Hajj to Mecca, and then all of a sudden Malcolm X was had his moment on the road to Damascus. And then, of course, black Muslims assassinated him because all of a sudden he was not willing to spout. This is a white person's way of looking at that history. He was not willing to continue to spout the black Muslim rhetoric. So I don't know. Is Barack Obama somehow connected to Minister Farrakhan, or is Minister Farrakhan trying to attach himself to a black man who may become the first African-American president of the United States? You know, who knows? Who knows? Don in Augusta writes, Mike, thank you for pointing out the first vote to go to war, Mrs. Clinton's first vote. She and her supporters want the Democratic primary voters to accept her explanation of her vote. She acts as though her votes occur in a vacuum. We all remember the atmosphere and events as they occurred at the time. There was absolutely no doubt the Genghis Khan of 2003, Bush, was going to war. Several people and groups were out there opposing this action. Scott Ritter, Code Pink, Answer, and so forth. What was reported at the time was Senate Democrats were going to vote on the war and give Bush his war to get it off the agenda so they could move on to more pressing issues. Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy received anthrax to push their little scary asses into holding votes. So no, Mrs. Clinton cannot at this point expect those of us who vehemently oppose the war and still vehemently oppose it to accept her lame-ass excuse for voting the way she did. Don in Augusta.
Coexist peacefully if we don't cave into desire. You can't take the high horse and then claim the low road. The past is over, I agree. We all know.
He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior. With Mike Malloy.
Look at the state of the world that we live in.
21 past the hour, a couple of emails here, and we are going to get your calls right after the next break. This is from Alan in Oakland, California. Mike, on September 6, 2006, Hillary Clinton sided with every Republican and helped defeat an amendment to a military appropriations bill that would have forbidden our use of cluster bombs in civilian areas. Clearly, she has no problem with allowing children to be maimed and killed by these horrible devices designed to look like toys or food packages. The company that makes these is a contributor to her campaign. Barack Obama voted in support of the amendment to ban the deployment of cluster bombs, but due to a handful of turncoat warmonger Democrats like Hillary Clinton joining with the bloodthirsty Republican war criminals, the amendment failed. Whenever I tell a Clinton supporter about this, it seriously shakes their support for her. Too bad the mainstream news would never let the public know about this important piece of her record that Hillary claims she wants the voters to consider. It's from Alan in Oakland, California. Jan in New York City writes, Mike, I voted for Clinton in 2000 and was happy to do so twice, primary and general election. When the war vote came, I phoned her office and begged them to have her vote no. I reminded them that we had that long, horrible embargo against Iraq, They were rude and dismissed me. I phoned again and told them she was losing me, and if she was losing me, she was losing her base. They hung up on me. Mike, I was in tears, and they hung up on me. Clinton drove me and every New Yorker I know away from her. From Mike in Connecticut. Mike, I was at the United Church of Christ event where Bill Moyers and Obama spoke. There was not one peep about any political party or his potential candidacy for president. He spoke of faith, hope, and kindness. That's all. Oh, now I see. That is everything those morally hollow Republicans could never understand or relate to. How in the hell can anyone go after a person for speaking about faith and kindness? Mike from Connecticut. And then this one from Norway. Mike, it's great to be listening to your show again. Recently, I've had brief moments of optimism about the USA, but they do not last long. Why? Because of the 2004 election. As I've told many people, the U.S. can be forgiven, sort of, for falling for Bush's uniter, not divider, and compassionate conservatism rubbish in the 2000 election. But in 2004, we all witnessed the U.S. elect, not re-elect, Bush. So we all know that most Americans favor torture and mass destruction abroad, and we have since learned that most Americans only care about ending war when their wallets become flattened. But the enthusiasm I see for both Hillary Clinton, who I'm skeptical about but open to, and Barack Obama, who I'm guardedly admiring, the enthusiasm I see for both of them in ordinary Americans touches me. It seems like something genuine is stirring in the USA. Just maybe the USA can start to cast off the lethal naivete that is enabling people as bad as any Europe has produced to have their way with your gargantuan and powerful nation, and get down to the work of informing itself, hard work that is required to make a democracy work. Did not Jefferson write somewhere that for a democracy to work, an informed citizenry is required? So, I am a little teeny bit optimistic, but then I remember 2004, and I am sorry to say that I pretty much expect Americans in general to allow that old fascist McCain and the media to crush Obama in the election. Sometimes I feel bitter and old at 36, but I look at you. You're older than me and have been fighting for truth and justice for so long, and if you can soldier on through this hurricane of frustration, then I have to try and keep my faith up myself. I'll try. No promises. Greetings to all your listeners. Kent in Norway. Letters from listeners here. One last thing that crossed the Malloy show desk. This is a record week for oil and gasoline prices, if you don't factor in inflation. We still haven't reached the point it reached in the Reagan years. I think it was 1982, where if you factor in inflation or use 2008 dollars, gas was selling for $3.40 back then, the equivalent. We haven't gotten there yet, but according to the Houston Chronicle, fuel inventories in this country are at a 14-month high. Gasoline demand is down nearly 4% from this time last year. The U.S. economy is sluggish, and there is so much gasoline in the United States, it is actually being exported to some of it to oil-rich Nigeria this month. Do you understand what ExxonMobil and the rest of these son of a bitches are doing to us? The oil companies, the gasoline industry is gouging us while they are exporting oil or gasoline to Nigeria. Oil set a record Tuesday, closing at $100.88 a barrel on the New York Mercantile, and set an intraday high this morning by reaching $102.08. One of the experts in a research fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy said, based on historic relationships between crude oil and gasoline, retail gasoline should be priced closer to $3.63 a gallon if oil remains at $100 a barrel. We are exporting gasoline to Nigeria. We have a 14-month high in our fuel inventories, and the price at the pump keeps going up. We'll be back after the break. Yeah. Come on, get up and get up, 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 get up,
lot of gas reserves around the world. Gas is, can only be transported by ship, though, when you liquefy it, when you put it in solid form.
If you're looking for a summer job, we have this from Senator Larry Craig's website. This is a press release. This is for real. Press release from the 26th, which is, what, was that yesterday, Kathy? I don't even know. Neither do you. What the we don't know what date it is. The headline is Craig accepting applications for summer interns, and it says, Idaho Senator Larry Craig is currently seeking intern applications for the summer term, which runs from May to August. The application deadline is March 15th. However, if more time is needed for the application process, please contact Senator Craig's office for an extension. Craig offers paid internships within the Washington, D.C. office. Preference is given to Idaho applicants attending Idaho schools who are in their junior or senior years of college. You can find this at Larry Craig's website. Oh, I'll bet there's just a rush of parents suggesting their kids take that job.
Well, I wonder what his position is on internships.
His position?
What his stance is.
His stance?
Is it wide? Is it narrow?
You're terrible. Julia in Roseville, California writes, Mike, thanks for sharing Joyce's letter with us. She's referring to our Arkansas Bureau Chief's letter that I read. It's always good to hear what's going on in the collective consciousness. However, the only thing I hear in Joyce's letter is fear. So what if Obama has very loose ties or associations with Farrakhan? Does Joyce think that Obama is some covert agent who will turn against us and let the terrorists in this country bomb us? What on earth is she thinking? Aren't we sick to death of the fear that has permeated this country by the Bush administration? Even though he was raised by a single mother who didn't follow a particular church, even though his mother and father's families were somewhat agnostic, at a minimum, Barack Obama has a certain amount of understanding about Islam. How can this be a bad thing when we are currently in a quagmire in Iraq? Isn't Obama our best hope for some kind of diplomacy that has utterly failed with the Bush administration? Julia. In California. I don't think, Julia, that Joyce was necessarily referencing Minister Farrakhan's connection to, as tenuous as it is, to Islam. I think what Julia was, Joyce was talking about, writing about, was referencing Farrakhan's racism and anti-Semitism. Which I think anyone who has paid any attention to Farrakhan's career, even though he seems to have repudiated his anti-Semitism, it's my understanding, although I've only heard this secondhand, that at one point he had rabbis come into his building in Chicago, on Chicago's South Side, rather elaborate building, if I say so myself, and forgive him for his anti-Semitic craziness over the course of his preaching lifetime. So, I don't know. But I think what Joyce was talking about was Farrakhan's racism and just the kind of feeling that white people have that are attached to Farrakhan. And, I know. I'm a white person. It's not a very good one. I always saw Farrakhan, though, as less of a threat to anything and more of a posturing little banty rooster that just found a way to run his scam, like a lot of preachers do. I don't care what the religion is. I don't care if it's Protestant or Catholic or Jewish or certain aspects of Islam. Certain aspects of all of those that I just mentioned, they figure out how to run a scam and they run it. And eventually they, they ask forgiveness or they go to prison or whatever. As far as the black nationalist aspect of the Nation of Islam, I think that's the main thing that freaks white people out. Just like the Black Panther movement back in the 60s, to see young black men walking down the streets exercising their Second Amendment rights by carrying weapons was just unnerving to white people. And the good that the Panthers did, whether it was preschool or after school programs for working mothers or lunch programs or helping the poor or helping the sick or setting up self-help communes and food co-ops and on and on and on, that was washed away by the fact that the Panthers had some fairly intense anti-white rhetoric. What the hell? You know, let me go back to the 60s and be a young black man. You want to, well, I've said it before, had that been me, I would not be doing this program now. I'd be dead or in prison or in a mental institution. Come on, folks. Let's not play pretend where it concerns race in this country. Let's not play pretend. And I think one of the aspects of Barack Obama's campaign is whether anyone talks about it or not, or if they just barely talk about it, he is raising the race issue in a way that's never been raised for white folks before. Al Sharpton's presidential candidacy 4 years ago, 3 years ago, was a joke, and everybody knew it was a joke. In a joke in the sense of his ever getting elected. Jesse Jackson, even though Jesse Jackson won a number of the Democratic primaries, everybody knew that Jesse Jackson was not going to be the president of the United States. But people are starting to realize that this candidacy by this black man has a real potential to in succeeding. So the issue, the discussion about race is going to come bubbling up, and it's going to come bubbling up in a lot of injurious or bad or hurtful ways. It just is. This is the United States of America. It hasn't been that long ago that white folk were allowed to keep black folk as property. So, any connection to someone like Farrakhan is seen as threatening or not understood or understood all too well. It depends on, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, I've got to drop this in because once I start taking phone calls, I'm just probably not going to get to it. I got this email also today. This is scary as hell. This is from Jesse in Boynton Beach, Florida, who is one of the NOVAM founding members. Mike, the right-wing think tank named the Defense of Democracies has been running slick commercials here in Florida, trying to scare people to tell their Congressman Ron Klein to vote to allow the spying on us to continue and thus save ourselves from destruction. These commercials must take big money to run or are definitely produced by professional marketing people. I can't imagine why people still fall for this swill, but they do. I Googled the name The Defense of Democracies and easily came up with who is behind this. It's like PNAC, Project for New American Century, revisited. I'm sure the telecoms are funneling a lot of cash into this to buy their immunity. Now, here's what it says. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, that's the name of it. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, FDD, is a think tank that claims to conduct research and education on international terrorism, the most serious security threat to the U.S. and other free democratic nations. This is from their website. FDD produces independent analyses of global terrorist threats. The work is closely linked with that of the National Endowment for Democracy. Now, a lot of you, your heads just snapped because you know what the National Endowment for Democracy is. It's an institution set up to overthrow foreign governments that don't allow corporate America to have their way with them. But here's the interesting part. The board of directors includes Steve Forbes, Dr. Jean Kirkpatrick. I thought she recently died. I don't know. Jack Kemp. The distinguished advisors are Judge Louis Free, former director of the FBI, James Woolsey, former director of the FBI, Newt Gingrich, Joe Lieberman. The board of advisors includes Gary Bauer. You remember him, the little turtle-like, strange little dude who wanted to be president to bring Christ into your life. Donna Brazil, campaign manager for Al Gore 2000. Eric Cantor, Representative Eric Cantor, Republican of Virginia, Representative Elliot Engel, Democrat of New York, Frank Gaffney, who is the president of the Center for Security Policy, that's another right-wing organization, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, former ambassador to Morocco, Charles Jacobs, who is the president of the American Anti-Slavery Group, Charles Krauthammer, you know who he is, extreme right-wing, psychopathic, failed psychiatrist who is now a columnist, William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, Richard Lamb, former Colorado governor, Jim Marshall, Democrat of Georgia, Zell Miller, former U.S. senator, Richard Pearl, Steve Pomerantz, former assistant director of the FBI, Buck Revell, Oliver Revell, former associate deputy director of the FBI, Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York. These are the board of advisors to the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is running well-produced advertisements in South Florida telling people to let your congressperson know, your member of the House know, that you want immunity for those telecoms and you want the Bush crime family to have the right to spy on us without warrants because, well, you know, them terrorists are out there. Charles Schumer, Donna Brazile, huh? Interesting.
For Richard Pearl. I don't care what it is, I will step right in it. Before I'd vote for Bill Bennett. They'll take over the world.
Time to snuggle up with your favorite screamer, more Mike Malloy.
All right, regarding the that think tank I just mentioned to you that Jesse wrote about from Boynton Beach, Florida, what was the name of it? The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I get this from Kathy in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Those commercials are running, she writes, in Northeast Wisconsin as well, and a number of board members resigned today, including Donna Brazile, Chuck Schumer, all the Democrats except Zell Miller and Lieberman. Of course, he's not a Lieberman. He's not a Democrat anymore. Kathy in Green Bay, P.S., which begs the question, what were they doing on the board to begin with? Yeah, well, it's there you go. For a Boynton Beach listener, the Democrats have resigned. But, yeah, why did they resign? Because word got out? I mean, what the hell are they doing there? Oh, God. Reg at TVNewsLies.org. Regarding Hillary cluster bombs in Israel, she writes, come on, this vote was not about kids dying in Iraq. Hillary's refusal to vote for an amendment that would ban cluster bombs. Reg writes, come on, this vote was not about kids dying in Iraq. It was about Lebanese children dying as a result of Israeli cluster bombs made in the U.S. In 2006, the U.S. lifted a ban on selling munitions with cluster explosives to Israel at the request of the Israeli government, which claimed these deadly bombs were needed to counter the threats from Hezbollah. Banning them by the U.S. would also prevent the sale of cluster weapons to Israel, whose Supreme Court recently determined that these lovely bombs were perfectly legal during the ill-fated attack against Lebanon. The Jewish vote is the smallest of any minority in the U.S. The entire Jewish population is less than 6 million, and that includes those who are not old enough to vote. But obviously, it's always a sought-after vote. Go figure. Pragmatism over humanitarianism, always. And this one, from Chris in Mesa, Arizona. Mike, as we find ourselves wrapping up the Democratic primary season, I find it interesting that John McCain can muster up enough grace to denounce Bill Cunningham's remarks in Ohio. That was the talk show host that made a total ass of himself introducing McCain. But, Chris writes, some of Clinton's supporters, like your listener from Arkansas, continue to inject the politics of fear into this race through the use of blatantly racist tactics. We are liberals, for God's sake. Are we really supposed to believe some of the disinformation that came with that email? Muslims attend a Christian church? Not that it would matter if they did, and such behavior would warrant a Muslim being put on a hit list here in the United States? You got to be kidding me, right? It's amazing that some Clinton supporters have the audacity to call the Obama campaign Rovian. I fear that this will be terribly damaging to the Democratic Party, and it makes me sorrowful that Democrats are attacking other Democrats in this manner. I plead with your listeners to keep this race above the belt and about the issues. Spreading this tripe hurts and discourages us all. Chris in Mesa, Arizona. I'm really at a loss here to understand the ugliness that is flying between the Obama and the Clinton camps. I really am. Now, an astute listener will say, well, you know, why are you surprised? You're doing the same thing. And I would respectfully reply to that by saying, no, I'm not. What I'm trying to do is to present the records of these two candidates. I'm not talking about what their attitude is toward race or gender or gay folk or praying or church attendance or, you know, any of that at all. I don't think if it's slipped out, okay, because in the bottom of my heart, I don't support either Obama or Clinton. They are not the candidate that I would like to see as a Democratic nominee to be president of the United States. They just are not. They are not Democrats. There's something else running on the Democratic Party's platform. And once again, I, like most Americans, are being given a choice. You want John McCain, or do you want either Hillary or Barack Obama? And in that instance, I'm going to choose Barack Obama. I'm not a supporter of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. If Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, then by God, I will vote for her. Because I've allowed myself, as an American citizen, to be backed into this kind of a situation. And you know, when I say that, if Hillary is the nominee, I will vote for her. If Barack is the nominee, I will vote for him. You know, in my imagination, I can hear corporate America laughing its ass off and just saying, "That's it, Malloy! You're goddamn right! That's what you're gonna do! You're gonna vote for either Hillary or Barack! You bet your ass you are, boy!" And that's exactly what we want. I hear that. Are you kidding me? Of course I hear that. So what do I do? I know. I can organize a third party. No, that takes a lot of work. I know. I can roll the clock back to, oh, I don't know, the late 60s, early 70s, and advocate that the American public not give up its right to vote. Please don't elect presidents with 44% of the vote or 51%. Please. No, that's stupid. I can't roll the clock back. Okay, what do? I know! Lead a revolution! No. I'll wind up at Guantanamo. What can I do? I know. I can vote the Green Party. But I'm not going to be alive long enough to see my votes to the Green Party candidates manifest in a Green candidate president. I'm just not. So what do? When Election Day comes, I go in and vote for either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. That's what I do. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Malloy here on the Novam Radio Network. Okay, y'all are really filling up the inbox now with stuff about this so-called bipartisan group, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Talking Points Memo, Joshua Micah Marshall's website, reported Monday that this group launched a national ad campaign lambasting House Democrats for not passing the Senate surveillance bill, which comes with that retroactive immunity for the telecoms. As of last Friday, the group, which claims to be nonpartisan, boasted a number of Democrats on the Board of Advisors: Donna Brazil, Senator Chuck Schumer, Representative Elliot Engel of New York, Jim Marshall of New York, and former Governor Zell Miller. Governor? He was also a senator. Joe Lieberman is listed as a Democrat on the site. Since the group launched the ads, Brazil, Schumer, Engel, and Marshall have all resigned from the group. In her statement, Donna Brazil said that no one from the group had consulted her about his activities, quote, in years, end quote, and that the once, quote, bipartisan organization, end quote, had, quote, due to the influence of their founders, morphed into a radical right-wing organization that is doing the dirty work for the Bush administration and congressional Republicans, end quote. Talking Points Memo alumnus Spencer Ackerman reported on the resignations at the Washington Independent this morning. He cites Democratic sources as saying that Joshua Marshall was appalled by the ad. Schumer also said, or no, Representative Jim Marshall, I'm sorry, was appalled by the ad. Schumer also said that he hadn't been consulted about the group's activities and that he regretted the, quote, partisan agenda that the organization has pursued, end quote. Brian Wise, the group spokesman, said that he was sorry that the center feels that way, but that the ads are not political ads. They're issue-based ads. Oh, my God. The ads target 15 House Democrats. They're being run nationally with a slightly different version airing in local markets. The ads are encouraging viewers to contact the representative and urge them to convince the House leadership to bring the Senate bill to a vote because, quote, the law that lets intelligence agencies intercept al-Qaeda communications has expired, crippling surveillance, which is all a lie. Jesus, God. Defense, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Oh, I want to join that. I want to defend democracies because, you know, Nazis and corporatists and Islamic crazies are taking over and Christian fundamentalists. I want to defend. And then you and so you send in your $20 and you get the bumper sticker and the pin and you go, oh, well, I'm doing something. You know, I don't have $20, but I'm doing some defense of democracies. Yeah, that's got to wash back on me and the United States. Yeah. And then you find out it was all a scam and that they're goddamn Nazis running this organization. That they are nothing but scum-sucking right-wing Nazis. They are Limbaugh thugs. They are Hannity animals. Nothing but thugs who want to destroy the country. Well, anyway, thanks to our listener in Point Beach for sending me the original email. You know, I'm sorry, I don't get out much. I don't watch that. It sounds like I watch CNN and MSNBC and the networks, but I don't. You know, I flip through a couple of times a day just to see, okay, have there been any mass shootings? No. Okay, what's the number on the stock market? Okay. Has Bush resigned? No. Okay. Have we invaded someone else? No. Okay. All right, what's the weather? So I didn't know these. Steve wrote in, told me that the ads have been running on CNN. Let's see if the ads continue to run now that we all know, or we should know. And was it Talking Points Memo? Was it Joshua Micah Marshall's site that uncovered this nest of rats and scum and filth and America haters? Was it? I'll tell you, the Nazis have been trying to take over this country since the Roosevelt years. The American fascists have been trying, everybody from George W. Bush's grandfather to Charles Lindbergh. I mean, the list goes on and on. And the sons of bitches are still trying. They're still trying. They're trying desperately. They've got us into wars. They have undermined our Constitution. They have disguised themselves as occasionally as Democrats. They most often have been Republicans. They have advocated against anti-nuclear treaties. They've told us that the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. Now it's the Muslims are coming. The Muslims are coming. At one time, the Negroes are coming. The Negroes are coming. Before that, the Catholics are coming. The Catholics are coming. Oh, wait, I guess the Nazis and the Catholics got along okay. I mean, it just hasn't stopped for 70, 80 years. The effort to turn this country into a fascist state has been unrelenting, and it still goes on. It still goes on. Foundation for democracies. Ooh, yeah. Why even say it? All right. Let's do some phone calls. I keep promising, and I just drift off. You all write very intense emails. Starting with Tom in Canoga, California, listening on the Internet. Tom, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Mike.
Hey.
I thought you'd like to know that I listened to the audiobook of Barack Obama's Audacity of Hope.
Uh-huh.
Like a typical American, I voted for him in the primary first, and then I listened to his book later.
Uh-huh.
My brother said that he won a Grammy Award for Best Spoken Word, because it was his actual words, and it was done very well.
Really?
I'm not
surprised. He's got a good, if nothing else, he's got a good speaking style, a very intense speaking style.
Actually, I like his style of writing. This is his second book, actually. And it's kind of interesting because in the first part of the book, first two chapters, he says things like, well, I believe in this, but I also believe in that. I believe in this, but I also believe in that, kind of like a typical politician.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, gee, if you're not going to impress me if you don't distinguish yourself, you know. And the next couple chapters, he talks about his home life.
Mm-hmm.
When he was growing up, he grew up with just his mother,
mm-hmm.
and his grandparents were there, too. And then the next couple of chapters, he kind of talks about finding religion, finding God.
Mm-hmm.
And neither his mother or his grandparents were very religious. He didn't
right.
have a religious upbringing.
Right.
And so but then he kind of talks about finding God. And when I thought about it later on, after having listened to the whole thing, that part of it didn't seem that authentic to me. I kind of get the impression he's a rationalist. I don't think he's a man of faith, my impression. But then later on in the book, he talks about his in the Illinois legislature, and he says that he comes right out and says that he didn't have any big distinguishing bills that he introduced. He kind of admits it, that he gave amendments to other people's bills, but because he was sort of a junior there, kind of a freshman he kind of goes on and on trying to say that he did other things, but, you know, my mind phased out, sort of like it did when the first George Bush talked, you know, just kind of like...
Okay, sum it up for me here. Why are you telling me about his book? Bring it to a close here.
I'm telling you about his book because he taught constitutional law for 10 years.
Right.
And that made me feel good to hear that.
I see.
And I think if he becomes president, he's going to... the judges that the Supreme Court justices that he might
mm-hmm.
elect are going to be
people who respect the Constitution.
People who respect the rule
right.
of law. In fact, there was two times when I actually had tears in my eyes, Mike, when he talked about the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and the rule of law. He's a lawyer. His wife is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
She graduated from Princeton, and he, you know, and then I got the impression that he's going to be someone who. Of course, our process creates people who are middle of the road, you know.
I'm glad you shared that with us, Tom, but I keep remembering what Jim Hightower has said about the middle of the road. The only thing you find there is a yellow line and dead armadillos. But thanks. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
R. Pigglesbush. When Georgie falls asleep, I creep into the Oval Office, sneak a ciggy, and turn on Mike Malloy. Then I reprogram Georgie's speed dial. The simple pleasures.
21 past the hour. Steve writes, actually, there was another mass shooting today in Tennessee at a housing complex. Four dead, including the shooter. The story has been scrubbed. The original story ran this afternoon on CNN, but now cannot be found anywhere. Also, there was a seven-person shooting in Los Angeles this evening. So now the mainstream media is burying mass shootings. Actually, it was eight wounded in Los Angeles street shooting. A gunman fired in a crowd of children, adults at a South Los Angeles bus stop, wounding eight. Three girls ages 10 to 12 and a woman were in critical condition. Blah, blah, blah. In Bristol, Tennessee, a man fatally shot four people at a public housing complex in downtown Bristol, Tennessee, and then committed suicide. Oh, my God. Regarding the Democracy organization that is nothing but a right-wing neo-Nazi front organization, Suzanne in North Miami writes, those ads are running on MSNBC. Over a week, during Keith Olbermann's countdown and Dan Abrams as well, the narrator gives Ron Klein's telephone number and asks that people call him and tell him to vote yes so that our government will be able to wiretap the terrorists. It's unbelievable, Suzanne writes. And regarding Schumer and the Democrats who resigned, what the hell did they think that an organization which Bill Kristol was involved would be? They have to stop thinking that these folks are harmless so that we can form some sort of coalition with them. As John Edwards used to say, there are some people that you don't invite to the table. They'll eat all the food and then they'll steal the silver. Back to your phone calls. Tony is calling from Atlanta, listening on XM. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Doing fine. How are you?
Great. You know, you were talking about William F. Buckley, your first hour.
Yeah.
And I was just compelled to call you. You know, William F. Buckley, like so many Eastern yuppies, was involved in sailing, and he considered himself a great athlete in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I will never forget, back in the 80s, and you have to forgive me, I can't remember the guy's name, but a very prominent blind man who was involved in sailing wrote an essay on the exhilarating therapy of sailing for the blind.
Mm-hmm.
And William F. Buckley was so incensed that somebody who, shall we say, lacked the human qualities of sight could be involved in sailing that he was just really incensed by it and wrote this long screed about nobody who was blind could possibly enjoy sailing. And I remember just being struck like lightning that this guy was obviously a fascist.
Yeah, you know, get the people who in the minds of the fascists are less than up to snuff where it concerns physical attributes. Get them in line. Right in front of or right behind the Jews? Right in front of or right behind the homosexuals? Anyway, get them in line and let's march them into the chambers. That's why it's appalling to me on the one hand that media today are talking about Buckley as though he were some iconic good guy. He was iconic, all right, but nothing on the side of good. I can't wait to see the New York Times tomorrow. I will guarantee you to be on the front page.
Yeah. Anyway,
praising him for all the wondrous things he did, and then, of course, there'll be that little caveat, well, not everybody agreed with him, and he was argumentative and so on and so forth. He was a Nazi. He was a fascist. There is no question.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you.
All right, Tony, thanks for checking in.
I appreciate
your call. We got a break here? Yeah, we got a break coming up, don't we? Oh, got a minute? All right, let's get Charles on here. Charles is calling from Phoenix, listening on Sirius. Charles, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Charles.
Good to visit with you here. I have been listening to you for a while, and I just wanted to say that I listened to your comments about Michelle Obama and, mm-hmm. and this whole thing of her saying that she was really, for the first time, proud of being an American.
Right.
And how people took that.
Yeah.
And your sense of defense.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm an African American. I've been in sales for, about 28 years. And your statements moved me so much that I just said, I just got to give him a call and just compliment you on that.
Well, that's very kind, Charles.
Well, no one could have ever said it any better and plainer for the listeners out there to understand that it's tough being African American and growing up truly through the early years, because I'm 53, and I know that this country has come a long ways,
mm-hmm.
but I'm here to tell you that we aren't even close to realizing the fact of how much trauma this has put on one race of people.
I hear you. Charles, let me put you on hold. I have a feeling there's a little bit more you want to say, and I got a break here. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Drive out the swine. Am I only falling, Father? Can you keep me safe from harm? The memories you build in the house on the hill, would you really change a thing? Correct.
Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, we were talking with Charles in Phoenix, listening on Sirius. All right, Charles, go ahead and wrap it up for me. You were saying very kind things about me, I think, and I appreciate it.
Oh, yes. No, it was easy for me to say. And, you know, just to wrap it up real quick here, as far as Michelle Obama is concerned, most people who are slightly intelligent, I think, can understand the relationship between when a person say that, hey, I like you, as opposed to saying, I really like you,
mm-hmm.
which that one word, really,
mm-hmm.
Kind of separates of that whole thing of where she was going with that.
Sure.
My belief. The other side of it is this Farrakhan thing, and this is my last little deal here, this Barack Obama and Farrakhan. I think Barack Obama, first of all, will separate himself from anyone who stands up and in a sense, preach hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Hatred is a cancer, and we do not have the luxury anymore in this country or in this world in general, Mike, to preach hatred.
Mm.
I'm sorry. That's my feeling. That's all I have to say.
Well, that's exactly right on target. Thanks a lot, Charles.
You bet.
All right. Appreciate you checking in. No, we don't. We never did have the right to preach hatred or advocate it, but we have. And by the way, just as correction, I mentioned that spot for that right-wing organization was running on the Oberman show. A lot of spots on cable television are not programmed by the actual network. They're run by local cable companies. And in buying the ad that way, they buy it a lot cheaper than if they buy it through MSNBC's ad agency. So people who are seeing those ads on MSNBC and or CNN are probably seeing what is referred to as a local buy or a local cable buy. That's A. B, someone like Oberman does not have any say-so whatsoever, unless it's an extreme situation, as to what commercials run on his program. We have to keep in mind that MSNBC's parent company is NBC, whose parent company is General Electric, whose primary function is not to be in the television business, but to be a leader in the weapons industry and merchants of death. So if an ad runs that Keith Oberman doesn't like, he may have, I don't know what kind of, what sort of editorial control he has I know on this program, which is, I'm not comparing myself by any means to a television network, cable or otherwise, or Keith Olbermann, but any ad that I found absolutely objectionable would not run on this program. I don't know if Keith Olbermann has that editorial control. And again, not to compare myself, because there's no comparison. You know, I'm not in the league with Olbermann or MSNBC. But some people who have television or radio programs do retain the right to have a final editorial decision for obvious reasons as to what runs in their programs. So having said that, I just felt a clarification was necessary, and Kathy pointed it out that not all commercials you see on cable networks are bought through the cable network. They come as local buys. And this from Jessica in Cincinnati, who writes, regarding race introduced into this election, I brought up last hour. Jessica writes, the fact that Barack Obama entered the race brought the discussion of race into the campaign. But I have a question for the Hillary supporters. I've encountered many Hillary supporters that have emphatically stated, if Obama's the nominee, I'm voting for McCain. Okay, Jessica writes, why? Correct me if I'm wrong, but considering who McCain has supported, why would alleged Democrats want to forego putting a Democrat back into the White House? Am I wrong, or are these so-called supporters voting against Obama because he's black? Don't poo-poo me on this, Mike, but when I ask these alleged Democrats why, they hem and haw and talk about his middle name, or his inexperience, or his ties to a black supremacist church. Of course, the opposite has occurred when I ask Obamacans the same question. They automatically, to a supporter, say, if she's the nominee, they'll be voting for her. Jessica in Cincinnati. I don't know what you mean. Don't poo-poo me on this. I have no idea what you mean. But now, regarding Nader, Mike writes in, Nader's strategy is to force Clinton and Obama to become more fearful of those who might vote for him or her and thus move away from their corporate masters. Based on the competition between the two of them for the nomination and their fear that McCain will beat the winner in the general election. Here's the evidence, and he provides this from Tim Russert's interview last Sunday with Ralph Nader, a part of which we put on the program the other night when Nader said he was going to run for the presidency. Russert said, how would you feel, however, if your presence on the ballot tilted Florida or Ohio to John McCain, and McCain became president? And Barack Obama, the first African-American who had been nominated by the Democratic Party, this is hypothetical, did not become a president, and people turned to you and said, Nader, you've done it again. Nader's response, not a chance. If the Democrats can't landslide the Republicans this year, they ought to just wrap up, close down, emerge in a different form. You think the American people are going to vote for a pro-war John McCain, who almost gives an indication that he's the candidate of perpetual war, perpetual intervention overseas? You think the American people are going to vote for a Republican like McCain, who allies himself with the criminal, recidivistic regime of George Bush and Dick Cheney, the most multipliable, impeachable presidency in American history? Many leading members of the bar, including the former head of the American Bar Association, Michael Greco, absolutely dismayed over the violations of the Constitution, our federal laws, the criminal, illegal war in Iraq, and the occupation. There's no way. That's why we have to take this opportunity to have a much broader debate on the issues that relate to the American people. As a fellow in Long Island said recently, quote, these parties aren't speaking to me. They're not speaking to my problems, to my family's problems, end quote. And then Mike signs off, Obama has a narrow legalistic ideology. He shows no understanding of economics. I don't dispute that. As someone said, he was a professor of history. A professor of constitutional law. Did Ronald Reagan have an understanding of anything? And a lot of people consider him to be the creme de la creme of Republican presidents over the past, century. Did Lyndon Johnson have an understanding? Did Nixon? Did Roosevelt? What happens is if you're elected president, these candidates who become president are not just across the board full scope experts in every single subject that could possibly be involved in the governance of a country. And all the intricacies involved, dealing with foreign nations, dealing with the economy, dealing with blah, 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 on and on and on. That's where the cabinet comes in. That's where advisors come in. That's where staff comes in. So I don't expect Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama to be across the board experts. They might have specific areas on which they are expert. If Barack Obama's field of expertise is the Constitution, hip hip who damn ray. You understand what I'm saying? After what has happened to the Constitution under the last three presidents, are you serious? Or four presidents? Five presidents? If he is a constitutional, a professor of constitutional law, if he has that deep a knowledge of the Constitution, and that's his only qualification, where do I sign up? Back to your phone calls. Joe is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Put it simply, how the hell can I vote for Hillary Clinton for president after I've experienced Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, a woman who tells me that impeachment is off the table, she's got the Downing Street memo sitting right in front of her telling her what happened, then she hasn't taken the Patriot Act apart to find out what's in there, and then she's still accepting legislation from the White House.
Well, no, wait. Are you talking about, this has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton. I'm not defending Hillary, but you're talking about Nancy Pelosi.
Right. My problem is I've experienced a woman in a high office that hasn't done anything. That's my question. I voted for women all along, but no more. I've had enough.
My producer, Kathy, says, let this sexist pig off the phone. What do you mean you've experienced a woman in high political office and therefore you're not? What the hell are you talking about? Then you can't vote. Then how are you ever going to vote for a white man again?
Is she happy with Nancy?
No. Answer my question. You're the one that came to the show, Joe, tonight with a real heavy duty sexist statement that you're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton because you've watched what a woman does in a position of power. That's really over the top, Joe.
Listen, she's done nothing.
That's Joe, that doesn't make any difference.
Oh, it does make a difference.
If Nancy Pelosi runs for the presidency, don't vote for her. But don't say that. Oh, never mind. How are you ever going to vote for a white man again? Look what George Bush has done. How are you ever going to vote for a white man again?
No, that's not the point. The point
Joe, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to let you go before you piss off every single one of my female listeners. You're out of here. Kathy's sitting over there shaking her head. You just want to open up the microphone and say something nasty, don't you?
I would, but it's really not my place to talk, being an inferior woman.
Woman, yeah, I know, I understand. Whew. Come on, Joe, you can do better than that. Maybe not.
Well, that's as bad as Hillary coming in the debates the other day and saying that, you know, Barack and Bush were the same because they both promised change.
We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Ten before the hour, Steve writes, regarding Nancy Pelosi, the Pelosi-raptor is dangerous not because she's a woman, but because she's a corporate-controlled shill. Look up her financial asset report. She likes weapons, or at least her money does. Ten before the hour, thanks to the usual crew of reprobates who provided this program again tonight, Ian Huff. Co-produced, answered your calls, engineered, Billy Foster, technical director, Ben Birch is our podcast manager, Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher, and Bridget Wolf, our writer in residence, the executive producer of this program, is Catherine Bay. She's the one to write to if you are considering a lawsuit. Back to your calls here. Josh is calling from Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the mic, 92.1. Hey, Josh.
Oh, hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Cool. I realize I probably have like 30 seconds before the end of your show, but
I mean, I hate to defend the sexist guy who just called in, but the whole point of the whole gender thing and the whole point of the race thing is that it's about equality, isn't it? It's about people being able to be just as bad as the crusty old guys we have now.
Sure.
And giving them a chance. Sure. I mean, look at, you know, I've heard you say this 1,000 times about Clinton. Look at her policies. Look at her advisors.
Right.
The same thing about any other candidate we've got. And it's not about their gender. I mean, I keep seeing people on, you know, TV, Bill Maher, whatever, saying that once we get a woman in, she'll be kinder and gentler and nicer. But then, you know, you look at Margaret Thatcher and you look at everything else that women leaders have done, and it's not any different necessarily than a man would have done. So I think we're in a great place where we can actually say, yeah, equality is a great idea, but then they might be just as bad. So we need to look at the record,
but
the gender has nothing to do with it.
Right, but the caller was not saying what you're saying. He was saying he was saying something entirely different. You're absolutely right. I have no problem with what you're saying.
Cool.
you know, we talk about people other than white males being national leaders. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They should have an equal chance to screw everything up just like the white males have. That's
right, exactly.
That's not what the caller was saying. The caller was saying that because Nancy Pelosi is XYZ, therefore any other woman is going to be XYZ.
Yeah,
you
I see, can see that.
That's
see
what he was.
That, yeah.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah, there's
and
another
that's,
half of the
and
coin
that's,
of that one though. But
and,
yeah,
and that's and that's bat squeeze. I mean, was,
oh yeah, no, that's right. That's
was
exactly
Golda
right.
Meir like Indira Gandhi?
Right.
Oh,
right,
never
right,
mind.
Yeah.
Bad analogy.
Yeah, thanks,
but
Mike.
You understand what I'm saying? All right. Thanks.
I do indeed, man. Have a great night. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Josh. Appreciate what you said. Who else? What do we got here? Flo is calling from Sunrise, Florida, also listening on WINZ. Hey, Flo.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
I just want to let you know CBS4, a local channel, is running that ad.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of stations around the country are doing it. This is targeted to certain, apparently certain congressional districts where there is a Democrat who might be vulnerable in the upcoming election. And the ad is worded in a way that if you support that Democrat, you are supporting the terrorists.
Right. Ron Klein is the one.
Is
they
that...
show his picture, put his phone number. I called his office. They didn't know about the ad, but there's no rebuttal. So I said, why don't you put a rebuttal out there?
This is the genius of Nazis. This is the genius of fascists. It's American brand. It's difficult to rebut this the way they frame it. What are they going to say? What is Ron Klein going to say? Yeah, no. Listen, regardless of what the ad says, I'm really in favor of not granting the telecoms immunity. It's not that I'm in favor of providing access to of the terror. You see what I'm saying? It just winds up in verbiage that most people tune out.
Well, what it says is surveillance interrupted, and in other words, we don't have any surveillance now because of this.
That's insane. It's such a lie. I can see these Democrats putting up an ad that says what you saw is a filthy lie. The surveillance continues apace. Nothing has changed. But you know, Flo, we've talked about this many times. The American public, a high number of those who vote, are dumber than dog droppings. Who are they going to believe? A well-organized commercial that says what the president is saying, that not granting the telecoms immunity means the terrorists now have access to our bedrooms, or whatever the hell the argument is? Or are they going to believe a Democratic congressman who says that's a lie?
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's the evil inherent in these ads. What is someone like Ron Klein going to do?
Well, I knew the ad was a phony from the minute I saw it. But Ron Klein's office said only 30% want to go along with that, and
the
rest go along with the ad. So.
Yeah.
It just proves that they are ignorant.
It also proves that there are people in this country, and we've said this over and over again, and the people running this ad are perfect examples. There are people in this country, organizations in this country, corporations, the elite, the ruling elite, that want to absolutely destroy representative government flow and replace it with the brand of corporate fascism within which they will be extremely comfortable. They will pay no taxes. They will have no regulations. They will be able to do what they goddamn please. They will have a workforce that is being driven into the cellar in terms of wages. Corporate profits will increase and increase and increase. They will insist they're not responsible for economic degradation or mass killings as a result of putting a defective products or food or poison on the market. Just like ExxonMobil is arguing today that they should not be forced to pay a $2.5 billion fine for the damage they did off the coast of Alaska almost 20 years ago. That case is still going. $2.5 billion is what those son of a bitches make in terms of profit in about 3 weeks. That's what they want. And that's what this force that's operating inside this country is degenerate. It is vile. It is evil. It is filled with hate. It is anti-American. And I'll tell you something, Truth Seeker, if we don't start fighting like crazed sons of bitches in back at this force, we're going to lose it. We're going to lose it all. Every single bit of it. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.